Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. This program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Fred Monroe continues to host the program from home with continuing concerns about protecting us all from the COVID virus. Today, Fred expects a lively discussion about how political redistricting is often an exercise in the wielding of political power rather than fair representation of democracy. His guests include three political scientists who are the authors of Gerrymandering in the States, Partisanship, Race, and the Transformation of American Federalism. Join Fred and his guests today for a frank and important discussion. You're invited to listen, learn, and participate in our conversation today. You can call 805-549-8855 or email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. Now, let's join Fred and his guests. Over to you, Fred.
Hey, thanks, Brad. Glad to be with you today. I can assure you this will be a lively program. Get your pencil and paper out and take notes, and we'll also make sure that you know what the title of the book is and the authors as we go through this, because you may want to indeed take a look at this. We're going to talk about redistricting when it's done right and gerrymandering when it is done with question marks on it. And that's probably a discussion that you may want to be party to and talk about a lot. We are looking at a number of aspects of this that may come back to give us a lot to think about. My guests today are Alex Kina. He is an assistant professor of political science at Virginia Commonwealth University. Mike Latner, professor of political science at Cal Poly and a senior fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists Center for Science and Democracy. And Tony Smith, professor of political science and law at UC Irvine. We're going to discuss the causes and consequences of redistricting and basically how this tool affects how we are or are not represented fairly, both locally in county and city governments and in our representation in Washington and in the case of California, Sacramento. Gentlemen, I've been looking forward to this program ever since I knew that the three of you would agree to be here. Actually, Michael's been with us a number of times, and the fact that two of you would agree to be here with Michael makes for a good program. We weren't quite sure he was running people off or not these days. So, hi, Michael. Always glad to see what I can do to make fun of you before we start a decent program on politics.
Always good to be on, Fred. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah. This is a balancing act that I think is tough to sort out, because for an awful lot of people, redistricting is not important and not of consequence, but gerrymandering has always been alarming. And a lot of folks really have not put those two together as a, as butting heads or a tug of war. And from the book that you've written, I would assure our listeners that you've done a very good job of trying to convey exactly how frustrating this process can be. It's a local issue in San Luis Obispo County that's caused some consternation, if you will, about the local Board of Supervisors. I'm going to just do my best to get out of the way and let the three of you go at it here. So how would you folks like to start? I suspect you've probably already had a sense of how you would like this discussion to go, because we're not the first time you've had it.
Well, I think your point about this being a difficult issue to get one's head around is really accurate, in that for many of the world's democracies and most of the time, drawing legislative districts is an administrative task. And one of the reasons why we wrote this book, and why the first book that precedes this on congressional gerrymandering we wrote, was that something has changed, something fundamentally changed. And the last redistricting cycle at the national level was one of the worst gerrymandering exercises in gerrymandering that we've seen in this country. By our measures, possibly the second or third worst gerrymandering in the country's history. And what this book does is it explores both the causes, how we got here, and to your point, Fred, the consequences and why this should matter. And the one of the main points that, we make is that all many of the things that we hate most about politics and that people spend a lot of time talking about actually can be traced to gerrymandering in one way or another, and the manipulation of electoral districts and the manipulation of electoral laws. And that's really the connection that we seek to make in this book.
This is not a new issue. Okay, this has been around for a long time, but it seems to be a more caustic issue in a lot of circles right now. And I would pose to all of you, is there a, other than some of the obvious, rifts between government, between the left and the right being able to even have conversations lots of the time, what has brought us to this point that seems so more, combative than even I would typically say? I'm the oldest person in the room right now, and I'm 70 years old, but I haven't, and I've been reasonably politically active since I was a pre-teenager. I've never seen it as scary a time as it is now from a political standpoint.
I think one of the reasons that we're here is in part to challenge this idea that gerrymandering has been around a long time. It has been around a long time. It's been around for hundreds of years. But one of the things that changed is how gerrymandering is treated by the courts. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, starting a decade ago, we saw quite possibly the worst coordinated effort to gerrymander in the history of our nation. The way the Supreme Court sort of reversed in terms of treating voting rights and the administration of elections has a direct consequences for why we're here today. And so it stems from a court case in 2004, and I won't bore your listeners with the detail. It had to do with gerrymandering in Pennsylvania, and the court basically said, we can't find a way to measure gerrymandering. There's no constitutional standard for gerrymandering. There's nothing in the Constitution that says political gerrymandering is illegal. So we don't think that we can do anything about it. And that was basically four of the justices who said that. A fifth justice held out and said, maybe we can find a standard. But so it throws the legality of gerrymandering in limbo. And as a result, a bunch of smart Republicans led by Karl Rove and several others meet behind the scenes and say, listen, the court is giving us a gigantic signal here that we can do whatever we want and there won't be any consequences. So our role here is to look at what they actually did. And based on our evidence, we see this massive increase in Republican gerrymandering after the 2011 redistricting cycle, both at the level of the U.S. House of Representatives and a number of Republican-controlled states, but also at state legislatures across the country. And that's sort of the contribution that we make with our new book, is looking at what goes on in state legislative redistricting in the year 2011, 2012, when the maps were redrawn last cycle.
So I want to jump in there real quick. And just for any of your listeners that wonder what exactly do we mean by gerrymandering, the easiest way to understand it is the districts are drawn so that politicians get to pick their voters rather than voters picking their politicians. So it makes, whether it's a district, a congressional district, or a county seat, whatever it is, it makes it less competitive than it ought to be in a democratic system. And we see when we look around the country that politicians that turn to gerrymandering as the answer to keep them in power do it because if they tried to run on loyalty of their constituencies or value of their policies, they would lose. So this is a mechanism through which you can stay in power with a shrinking coalition of support and bad policy ideas. You rig it so you stay in power.
Tony, I'd like you to go back and talk about that. Basically, I actually highlighted it on my notes, and I'll re-paraphrase what you said. The current setup allows politicians to choose their voters instead of voters choosing their politicians. That was frankly one of the key things that I underlined it and bolded it on my notes to make sure I would understand that. I want to revisit that a little bit just with one question that from both what Alex said and then from what you tagged on to that. To some extent, it is a position that a minority party is always going to be stuck in, I think, if they want to try and retain power. And I don't want to get into why one party or the other is a minority. The reality is nationally, from a vote count standpoint and in a lot of places, the Republicans who still hold a lot of seats, both locally and in congressional positions, are minority parties. So my hunch is if you're the minority and you want to remain in a position to have adequate clout, you have to start looking at gerrymandering as a way to keep that power.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. But it's important to understand that's not the only way you could keep power. Historically in the United States, we started out with very few people actually being able to vote at the federal level, and with states having a mishmash of rules that all also excluded lots and lots of people. And over time, the suffrage or the right to vote was dramatically expanded to classes of people. And it's everything from women no longer being prohibited from voting. That's a pet peeve of mine when people say women got the right to vote. But before that, they had the right to vote taken away. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a gift. It was a right that they should have had all along. But you look at one of the outcomes of the Vietnam War is people, whether they were supporting the war or against the war, thought if somebody's old enough to go die in Vietnam, they should be old enough to vote. And people on both sides thought, we're going to be able to expand our coalition to get more voters. So one way you could win if you're in a minority party is to expand the coalition of voters that support you. Harry Reid famously says, I want to belong to churches that are trying to get converts instead of running heretics out of the building. Liz Cheney is persona non grata in the Republican Party right now because she's not Republican enough. This is insane. Right. So then a third avenue to try to win if you're in the minority party is come up with a better idea. One of the reasons Republicans just were driven crazy by Bill Clinton is his triangulation policy. If he had an idea and you had an idea that was more popular, hell, he'd take the parts of your idea that people like and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to do that, too. So you can change your policy. If the policy is unpopular, that might be a more pro-democratic, pro-representative government, pro-democracy approach, rather than saying, I'm going to change the rules. It's like losing to the Patriots every year, or now Tampa Bay in the Super Bowl, and saying, well, we're just going to start counting Tom Brady's touchdowns for less. And that's how we're going to win.
Yeah.
So. Yes, minority parties do that, yeah. But it's not the only thing they could do. I'm sorry, yeah, go
Alex,
ahead.
Go ahead, jump in.
To add one thing to that, you kind of saw a glimmer of this happening in the mid-2000s when George W. Bush was trying to get Latino voters into the fold in the Republican Party, especially after the 2006 midterms. But what happens is what eventually becomes the Freedom Caucus, what eventually becomes the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party revolts, and any sort of hope for immigration reform dies. And so there are, you know, it isn't as though the Republican Party has just chosen this one thing. This has been a battle within the Republican Party for a few decades. And ultimately the forces of let's just rig the system have won out.
Yeah. And just for a little more historical perspective, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which the anniversary of which is coming up like tomorrow or the day after, I believe, one of the most important pieces of civil rights legislation in the country's history. That bill was a coalition of both Republicans and Northern Democrats that both saw exactly the advantages that Tony was talking about in terms of expanding the electorate and in terms of recruiting new voters into the fold. And I would add that when we look today at the series of restrictive election laws that we see being passed by GOP legislatures across the states, which becomes, you know, part of our analysis in this book, that is a fairly recent occurrence in the sense that you know, Republicans have not always been doing this. Indeed, some of the best innovations that we've seen in terms of universal vote by mail, automatic voter registration, these innovations were adopted by Republican Secretary of States in places like Oregon and Washington. Utah, the most Republican state in the union, is a universal vote by mail state. So I think it's also important to show that we can see these dynamics playing out. This is a particular wing of the Republican Party that has made this their primary electoral strategy.
And let me follow up on that a little bit. And it's really interesting because it's not clear at all, these voter restriction efforts, which go hand in glove with gerrymandering efforts, are actually going to do what the wing of the Republican Party that's trying to implement them thinks they're going to do. For instance, in Florida, many more Republicans vote by mail than do Democrats. So you may actually see DeSantis not reelected as governor because they've passed these laws that make it harder to vote by mail. The other thing that can happen when you super gerrymander, the gerrymandering scholarly community calls it dummy mandering, where you gerrymander so broadly that you accidentally make some of your gerrymandered districts more competitive than they should be, and you end up losing them because you were overconfident. And we kind of think of a competitive district as if the vote was less than 5 points, but you know, any given swell of anxiety or support or drama or whatever can eclipse that 5 point closeness, and you might end up having more competitive seats if you try to gerrymander too much. And one of the problems is the folks that are running this kind of fever in the Republican Party, it's not the Mitt Romneys of the world. It's not the Rob Portmans of the world who know how politics work. They know how government works. They've been around forever and understand it. It's the Madison Cawthorns of the world who don't know their history. They don't know the politics. They're very green. They're new at this. And they don't perhaps really get the ramifications of some of the choices they're making. And it, you know, when you let the amateurs throw up the tent, sometimes it's going to fall.
I jump in for a couple of seconds here, guys. I want to remind folks that you can be part of this discussion. You may have questions and observations about it. You can give us a call at 805-549-8855. You can also email us at voices@kcbx.org. Because we're doing some of this by email, I want to remind you, as I often do, that we don't necessarily have time for long emails that may take, frankly, a good portion of the program. But if you have some more complex questions or observations on this topic, I can assure you I will pass the emails that you send us along to my guests, who, as you can tell, love having a good discussion and may want to continue it with you at some point. So I wanted to get that out of the way to make sure we allow enough space for our listeners if they'd like to be part of this discussion. I'm sorry, it's hard to keep track of the discussion sometimes. I'm not quite sure who brought it up. But the issue of the fact that mail-in voting used to be seen as something that was a predominantly a Republican position, because most people who were old enough to not be able to easily travel to a polling place or were already homebound or whatever, tend to be more
stable
conservative.
Addresses. Yeah. You know, younger people tend to move around a lot more.
Yeah.
So mail-in voting is particularly useful for older folks who have had the same address for 30 years. You know, you don't lose your mail-in vote because you lived in four different dorms and six apartments in 5 years.
So what happened in 2020 that allowed enough Republicans to move against that effort and not realizing that they may be sabotaging their own voter base?
Well, I mean, initially, one of the causes of this was the former president of the United States himself, who vocalize what he saw as the threat of expanding opportunities to vote during a global pandemic. And so one of the things that we document in the book is actually, you know, one of the great tragedies of this pandemic is the way it was politicized. And then the way that we saw state legislatures react. And one of the things that we show is that as the pandemic gets underway, and this happens in the middle of the primary season, if you'll recall, right? So states, there are a handful of states, Ohio and Wisconsin, that are basically stuck in the middle, and there are emergency decisions being made the night before the primaries. But, you know, once the primary season ended and we actually had a chance to look across the whole election cycle, what we found is that that politicization had real consequences in the sense that state legislatures reacted differently to the COVID crisis. And the more gerrymandered state legislatures, the GOP legislatures, they had not only were they less likely to expand options to vote for their citizens, where they were much less likely to expand absentee voting or to even expand early voting and other forms of convenience voting, or even allowing voters to fill out an application to vote by mail. Even that was restricted among GOP legislators. But we also saw that there were health consequences, Fred. And so when you look at the types of health measures that state legislatures took to protect their publics, we saw much less of an effort to expand Medicaid and expand the sorts of access to healthcare and public health ordinances compared to other state legislatures.
So
in part because of the gerrymandering.
And so let me tie it into why that is a result of gerrymandering for your listeners. So if you gerrymander the district, the only competition happens in the primary, because when the general election happens, you've drawn enough voters in that are of one party versus the other that, barring some sort of remarkable turnout failure by the dominant party, you know who's going to be elected in that district. At the state legislative level, you have hundreds of seats, thousands of seats across the country uncontested, because it's so gerrymandered, there's not really a point in spending any money on it. So that means that primary voters are the people that are actually choosing the elected official. And the primaries are set for weird times. They're not predictable times that people know and are aware of. They're often set in strange ways, so that it'll be on a Wednesday instead of a Tuesday, or on a or the polls will be relatively narrowly open. So if you work at night, you don't get to go vote in the primary. And often there are too many people running, or there are not enough people running. So people don't really pay a lot of attention, because the general public thinks the general election is the one that matters. But if you gerrymander enough, you only get the primary. So then what happens is the person with the biggest gun or the loudest complaint about immigrants, or for Republicans, if it's a Democratic gerrymandered, it might be the person who thinks Bernie Sanders is too conservative, or that AOC is not liberal enough. But, you know, that may be who they're running, depending on the district. But the candidate plays to the marginalized, highly active, very agitated populace that will overcome all the barriers to voting in the primary and vote because they're convinced that Hillary Clinton murders people, which is shocking if you think that Kenneth Starr and Monica Lewinsky are still alive. It's hard to believe anybody thinks Hillary Clinton kills people. But the pathology you get from having a primary geared towards the most uninformed but most easily agitated voter means you get people in office that are really just worried about that primary, and they may not have any sort of deep understanding of the mechanisms of government or the responsibilities of a democratically elected people to their broad constituents. They think of themselves as only representing their base. And that's why you get these pathologies. You know, all of the Republicans, from Tucker Carlson to Donald Trump, that have downplayed COVID, suggested people shouldn't get vaccinated. They're all vaccinated, every single one of them. And they got vaccinated before we did, I promise you. They even got vaccinated with Trump with stuff that isn't available to us yet because it's experimental stem cell stuff. So they know, though, that they're riling up these folks and they're selling them hats. And, you know, DeSantis is selling beer coolers going, how will I drink my beer if I don't, if Fauci does Florida or whatever it says? You know, it is this cynical manipulation because they know the swath of constituents they have to satisfy is narrow and unreasonable.
So the underlying theme from the notes I have from all three of you is that there is a way to there is indeed ways to fight gerrymandering, but it has not been effectively fought to this point. So I would pose that you can all three jump in any order that you'd like. What is the possible solution? And we've got a couple of minutes before we have to break at the bottom of the hour. That may be the best way for us to make sure the listeners stick around with us for the rest of the time. Because I think if we can explain a solution to this to anybody, I'd sure like to hear it.
So it turns out it's actually really easy. And surprisingly, before we wrote this book, we were wondering if any scholarship existed to look for solutions against gerrymandering. But shockingly, there really isn't a lot of work that's been done on asking what are the best ways to prevent partisan gerrymandering. And the very simple answer is just take politics out of it. Prevent politicians from dominating the process. Prevent one party from dominating the process.
Okay, Alex, and I don't want you to I want you to proceed, but I want to interject a question here. Sure. Before we proceed, and that is, if you already have the process of how things get redistricted, held politically, how do you break that cycle in the first place with the voters?
It's an excellent question. It's not easy. And I happen to live in a state, the very first state that actually where the legislature voluntarily ended its dominance on redistricting to establish a redistricting commission. And it didn't happen overnight. It happened because of mobilization, because of collective outrage, because voters kept inundating their representatives with mail and with petitions. And quite simply, it's just grassroots reform, grassroots pressure, and just hammering away year after year. And it took about 6 years here in Virginia for it to happen. But and it's also the right sort of political circumstances where Republicans were controlling government and they were on their way out, and they knew that the Democrats were going to come in the next election. And so that sort of brought the two parties together to do this. But the truth is, it's really simple to prevent partisan gerrymandering, at least. And that's just get normal people involved in the process, or experts, anybody who doesn't have an overt political agenda, and it works.
Let's hold it with that. We will come back to that topic. We're going to take a quick break here because I have a couple of questions for you on that, Alex, because I want to put a lead in out there. And that is that if we haven't been able to do it in California, where the Democrats control the legislature very heavily and in a lot of counties do not control the counties, I'm wondering how it's possible. With that, back to the studio with you, Brad, and we'll be back in this discussion in a couple of minutes. This is Central Coast Voices.
Thanks, Brad. We'll return to Central Coast Voices in just a couple of moments. Right now, this item from the KCBX Community Calendar, Art Center Morro Bay is offering a new workshop opportunity on August 21st, in which attendees will create hand-marbled silk scarves. Every student will dye their own unique scarf using the process and techniques to create beautiful patterns and colors. Pre-registration is required and all materials are included. You can check out artcentermorrobay.org for more details. And the KCBX Community Calendar features arts, entertainment, and of course, nonprofit events in San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, and Southern Monterey counties. You can submit your item or event to be shared through our calendar page on our website at kcbx.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. Voting rights for non-citizens. How a proposed bill in New York could turn the city into a national model.
This is an opportunity for New York City to really lead the country and lead the conversation in protecting and expanding voting rights.
That's this week on Latino USA.
On the next Fresh Air, the national conservative groups that funded the ballot audit in Arizona claiming the vote was fraudulent. We talk with the New Yorker's Jane Mayer about her new article, The Big Money Behind the Big Lie. She writes that those wealthy conservatives now want to let state legislators overturn elections. Join us.
The pandemic hit home, literally home, in so many ways. Parents kind of didn't know what to do.
The pandemic has really laid bare the cases in which not only is the data not very good, but there may just literally be none of it.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How to help yourself make the right decisions. Next time on Marketplace.
That's all still to come here this afternoon on KCBX. Stick around. We've got great information and entertainment coming up for you in just a little bit. Of course, we've got Latino USA coming your way at 2 o'clock, Fresh Air at 3, and then Marketplace at 4 o'clock. The time is 1:31. I'm Brad Kyle, and let's return to Fred and his guests here on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Fred.
Thank you, Brad. I appreciate it. If you're just joining us, we're talking about redistricting and gerrymandering with three incredibly well-versed authors and educators. Alex Kina, who's associate assistant professor of political science at Virginia Commonwealth University. Michael Ladner, professor of political science at Cal Poly and senior fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists Center for Science and Democracy. And Tony Smith, professor of political science and law at UC Irvine. Where we left it on the break, gentlemen, was if redistricting commissions will work effectively and the state of California legislature is very top heavy with Democrats and most of the challenges for gerrymandering in California seem to be related to counties and districts that are top heavy with Republicans, why is there not a state mandated redistricting commission for counties? And by the way, Michael, if you didn't notice, your other two colleagues have said, you're the guy that lives in California, so you get to answer first because you to come up with something.
This is one question where it really hits home, right, Fred, in the county that we live in, Slo County. You have a really purple county, and in many ways, Slo has for many years been kind of a bellwether of the state. Trump lost heavily in Slo County in the last election, as he did throughout California, and so the partisan swing of Slo County looks a lot like the state. It leans slightly Democratic now, and I think there's two really important points here about redistricting in California that we can at least start with. And one is that California was a leader in fixing this problem in the last decade. So California, through the initiative process, not the legislative process, but against the wishes of both political parties, frankly, because California had a very nice bipartisan incumbent protection plan that secured seats for both Republicans and Democrats in the last redistricting cycle in 2000, the citizens of California fixed that by creating a citizens redistricting commission. And one of the things that came out very clearly in our last book was that it worked, that California went from, you know, having a slightly Democratic favorable gerrymandered, but really an incumbent protection plan more than anything, to having a much more competitive elections and elections that that still benefit Democrats, but not through gerrymandering. And so you know, one thing that I think Republicans should, they're frankly not saying this enough, say that they are disadvantaged, and they are, but they're not disadvantaged because California's assembly and state Senate and congressional seats are gerrymandered. They're not. In fact, what they are is very responsive to shifts in public opinion. And so what we saw in the last decade in California was that the effect of a nonpartisan and independent commission actually had the effect of creating a very responsive plan so that whichever party's in the majority, in this case, the Democrats, they get a big bonus for every percentage of vote share they get. They get a bonus in terms of the seats they get. And so just to give you a quick example, in the last couple of election cycles, Republicans get about a third of the vote, maybe up to 40% of the vote in the state, which is still a minority, but they only got, I think, 13% of the congressional seats in 2018, you know, which was a year favorable to the Democrats, but still that's a problem, right? But that's a function of the responsiveness of single member districts, not a function of gerrymandering. And so we've basically fixed gerrymandering at the state level. Where we still have a big problem is that those rules don't apply to county governments and lower levels of government. And so what we have is a hodgepodge of rules. And in San Luis Obispo County, it's still the Board of Supervisors choosing their own legislative districts. And it doesn't have to be the case. So, for example, in our county right next door, Santa Barbara, they've established an independent redistricting commission, and it's citizen-led and citizen-driven, and it works. And so it's really, I think to Alex's point right before the break, it's up to people to get involved to ensure that they are heard and they create a structure that allows every vote to be counted equally.
Let me follow up on that real quickly. I'm in Orange County, and often the rest of California may not think we're part of California, but we are. We still are.
And behind the orange curtain.
We're behind the orange curtain. We have a really interesting situation, much like SLO, in that the county has kind of shifted. So it's much more purple. It's not a Republican county anymore. It's much more purple. Some of the congressional seats have gone back and forth, but it's you might say it's routinely voting for the Democrat for president now. And we have a board of commissioners that are doing things like they're trying to pass what looks like term limits for county commissioners. But we already have term limits for county commissioners here. But what they're trying to do is limit it to 8 years or 12 years. I can't remember which. But anybody that's already elected, it would be going forward. So they're trying to extend a bunch of them who are going to be term limited out are trying to extend their own ability to stay in power for well beyond the original term limits. And they're pitching it in a relatively dishonest way or a directly dishonest way, as if somehow it won't grandfather them in and keep them in power longer. And it's these sorts of things that, again, I get back to what I said at the very beginning. These are the signpost of politicians that no longer have policy innovation ideas and no longer have a coalition that supports them enough to get reelected. So because they can't get reelected on what they've done, the coalition's abandoned them, or what they're going to do, they don't have any policy ideas, they turn to fixing the game through gerrymandering.
Yeah. And Tony, you bring up a good perspective on this too, that I think is a factor for our listeners. This sounds like, when we're having this discussion today, this can sound to some people like this is a discussion taking aim at Republicans a discussion taking aim at the conservative members of the San Luis Obispo County supervisors. What it really amounts to, I think, is a discussion about how the current minority party is looking at ways to innovate themselves into a position to have more control. It happens to be the minority party right now in most places, with a few areas, exceptions in the South that we're not talking about necessarily, is the Republican Party. I think that's important to state from my perspective, because I really want our listeners to understand that this is a discussion about the issues of how power plays work out as opposed to picking on the Republican Party.
That's 100% right. This isn't a Republicans are terrible and Democrats are angels. And, you know, for me, politicians, it's a lot like they're a lot like dogs. You know, you wish they wouldn't drink out of the toilet, but you know they do. So politicians, regardless of their party brand, they are going to act in their own self-interest first and foremost. So if you reverse the situation where the Democrats were in a persistent minority situation, it wouldn't be a surprise at all to see them doing some of the same kinds of things. In fact, you might would even expect it. You know, in politics, there's a big or political science, there's a big debate about whether people that give lots of money to politicians are bribing the politicians or are they being held up by the politicians? You know, if you don't give me money, I'm going to do bad things to you. Versus if you give me money, I'm going to do good things for you. There are probably both kinds of politicians, both the bribers and the bribed and the extortionists. And they're in both sides of the aisle. That's not the issue. Thomas Jefferson, or rather the Federalist 10 says, if men were angels, we wouldn't need institutions, basically. Men and women are not angels. So we should go in being skeptical of those in power. And the best thing we can do is try to make sure the rules are fair so that we can pick the best alternative we can and keep in check those who don't do what the voters want them to do in the way they want them to do it.
I don't want to run out of time, and I don't want any point to kind of get lost, but I am concerned about one topic that's part of your book that we haven't really looked at, and that is the fact that there are really issues of race and racism in the gerrymandering process. I don't know which of the three of you has that perspective from the standpoint of the book, but please jump in and let's talk about that factor, because we are dealing with a society now that is paying better attention, hopefully, to the amount of systemic racism that still exists, but we don't seem to be looking at it from a standpoint of whether or not gerrymandering promotes it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So here's the thing. The way that people of color in this country vote influences how politicians who are controlling redistricting are going to make their decisions. What exactly does that mean? If you look at patterns across the country, not so much in California, but more so here on the East Coast and in the southern part of the country, what we see is that urban areas in particular are disproportionately Black, disproportionately Latino, disproportionately Democratic in their tilt. And that has to do with long, complicated trends that are decades in terms of how long it's unfolded. But what that means is that if you are trying to give your party an advantage, then having disproportionately Democratic voters clustered in the city can either help you or hurt you. If you're the Democrats, it makes it really, really hard to gerrymander. So you can look at a place like Wisconsin, where you basically have a state that's very much white and homogenous, except for Milwaukee. That means that if Democrats are in charge of drawing the lines, it's going to be really hard to make sure that they win more districts by splitting Republican voters. Republicans are spread out through the entire state, but Democratic voters are clustered in and around Milwaukee. However, if you're the Republicans, you're basically looking at your opponent like a sitting duck, and you can carve the Democrats by drawing a couple really tight districts. You get these majority Democratic districts that are like 90% Democrat. But the other side of the coin is what we're doing is we're diluting the votes of people of color, of historically marginalized communities. And this is particularly the case in the South. In the South, you have racial segregation, high degrees of racial segregation. You have the same in the Rust Belt as well, where African Americans are highly segregated relative to whites. But in the South, it's a problem that's obviously been going on for over a century, ever since the Civil War. And so what we found in this book, You know, there really isn't a lot of scholarship that links political gerrymandering with racial gerrymandering. And by the way, racial gerrymandering is simply trying to dilute the vote of a race group through the drawing of the lines. In our book, we wanted to be able to bring these two concepts together because we know they're closely related. We've seen evidence that they're closely related. It's no coincidence that in Virginia, for example, after the federal courts struck down a racial gerrymander, Democrats were able to win 3 seats out of the 11 congressional districts. It's no coincidence. And what we found is really compelling evidence that the way Republicans have been able to really gerrymander a bunch of Southern states so that they can win a lopsided majority of seats without even winning most of the votes statewide. I mean, that happens in regular occurrence in Michigan, for example, in North Carolina. The way that they're able to do this is by looking at the black parts of the state and drawing these super majority districts that have these huge majorities of African-American voters packed in. So instead of, you know, for example, African-Americans being able to win like 24 out of 100 seats in Virginia, they only end up winning like 16 out of 100. So in Virginia, that problem was remedied by a federal court. The congressional plan was struck down pretty quickly. And then eventually the House of Delegates, it took about 8 years, but eventually the House of Delegate plan was redrawn. Lo and behold, Democrats ended up winning the very next election. But there's a lot of other states where federal courts haven't addressed that problem. And so one of the ways that we know this exists, some of the evidence that we see in the book is that when we look at states with high degrees of segregation, what we see is that it leads to Republican gerrymanders, but only when Republicans were the ones who drew the map. You could have just as much segregation if a judge drew the plan or a Democrat drew the plan. You don't see a Republican gerrymander. And so for us, it's pretty compelling evidence that Republicans use race as a proxy for party, and they end up winning elections by basically targeting Black and Latino voters and drawing them into these heavily majority districts.
There's two quick things I want to say about that. One of them is our co-author who couldn't join us today is in Scotland. Tony McGann put a line in the book that I think really sums things up, and that is, after all, the districts don't draw themselves. They're drawn by someone with intentionality. But if you look at the cover of our first book, it's a colorized drawing of North Carolina and the different districts. And one of them that'll pop out to you right away is in purple, but it's Mel Watts' district back several redistricts ago because it kept getting redone by the courts. And it's this long, skinny line. And if you got down to a street level on that line, there are actually parts of his district where the line went down a street in the middle of the street, capturing no houses, and then captured one black house at the end of the cul-de-sac for the only African-American living on that street, so that every single potential black voter that the Republican legislators in North Carolina drawing that district could find were in that district. And it is such a dilution of the voting power of those folks. And yeah, it made sure that he was always going to be reelected with 80% of the vote or whatever. But it also meant that those immediately surrounding areas had virtually no African Americans in them when you were looking at a section of the state that had 30 to 40% of African American population. So,
very good point. And I want to remind folks, we're talking with the authors of this book. The book is called Gerrymandering the States, Partisanship, Race, and the Transformation of American Federalism. It is a Cambridge University Press book that is available. Some local bookstores may have it, and we may be to the point now where we're frankly mostly stuck with chain bookstores and Amazon. And I believe it from Tony, what you said earlier, it is available on Amazon.
It's available on Amazon. Walmart is carrying it online. Barnes & Noble is carrying it. Every online bookseller you can find has it. And if you can also just go directly to Cambridge University Press and buy it directly from them as well.
Wherever fine books are sold.
That's right. And it makes a wonderful gift, wedding present, birthday, everything.
Okay. All right. Put politicians on here. They know they're not for a couple of minutes. I don't know. No, I'm sorry. You're not politicians. You're political science professors.
That's
but
correct.
I don't know where we draw the line sometimes. What is the first book? We probably, to be fair to both you and to our listeners, this was a continuation of a process, and the first book is called?
Yeah, it turns out that we are much less creative in our book titles than in our science. And so the title of the first book is Gerrymandering in America, and this book's title is Gerrymandering the States.
And and we may next do Gerrymandering the Counties.
Right. And then Gerrymandering the School Boards.
Right.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We're almost to the end of the program. Anyway, and as most of my listeners know, I talk too much, except when I've got political scientists on. Three against one, I didn't have a chance here today. But I always let my listener, my guests have the last word. And since I don't want Michael Latner, the local guy, to get the last word, I'll start with Michael. So what are your final thoughts before we depart here today?
Fred. Well, first, just thanks for having us, and I think it's these kinds of discussions are really important as we are beginning a new redistricting cycle, and the census data is going to be available in late August, September, and we've got to do everything we can, I think, for citizens to be involved in this process. And I think one of the clearest signals that comes out of this research that we've completed is that you can change two things. You can change the opportunity for politicians to manipulate their boundaries, and you can change the motivation for politicians to do that. And you can do that through the establishment of independent redistricting commissions, taking away the opportunity for them to draw their own lines, which it's frankly, I think, absurd in the 21st century that we're still allowing politicians to choose their own voters. There's really no need. Our research demonstrates that independent commissions work, and we should be doing that at the federal, state, and local level. Second, I think the motivation is important, and that's where citizens really come into play. In terms of looking at electoral reform and the types of reforms that we know work and expand the voice and the power of voters to be heard, and we've got to get more people involved in this process, because otherwise we're basically just leaving it to the foxes to build the chicken house.
Thank you. I'm going to try and get the other California guy out of the way here. We'll get the last word will come from Virginia, one of our founding colonies. So Tony, you're up next, and Alex will have the last chance.
Right. What my final thoughts on this would be this. Some of your viewers, or rather listeners, might think of this as a partisan conversation, but it is not. What the parties stand for and believe changes over time, all the time. The Democrats went from the party of segregation and Jim Crow to the party of civil rights. Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, and now you might not think of the Republican Party as being at the forefront of Black Lives Matter. The point of which party is doing it isn't really the point. For the country to survive, for democracy to survive, the people have to diligently be in charge of who it becomes the politicians. If we ever dilute and eliminate the citizen control over government through elections, the country is lost. The Constitution won't matter anymore. And everything we wave flags about and get misty-eyed about when we watch sports or whatever, everything we claim to love about America will cease to be if we ever lose the citizen connection of control over government. So right now, at this moment in time, the Republican Party might be the primary bad guy. But 20 years from now, 30 years from now, all of those roles could switch. There could be new parties coming along. These are, the Jeffersonian Democrats are still around, sort of, but as in the Democratic Party. But really, this is not a partisan issue. This is an existential issue for the democracy itself and for the viability of our Constitution going into the next century.
Great. Thank you, Tony. Good point. Alex, you get the last of the last words.
All right. Well, I'll just follow up on Tony's point, which is that here we are on the eve of 2021 redistricting. And in fact, a number of states have already started redistricting. And we have the advantage of this cycle having the most scrutiny on the decisions of politicians who are drawing the lines than ever before. 10 years ago, the great gerrymander of 2012, as some put it, caught a lot of people by surprise, but people are paying attention now. And I will say the lessons that I have learned from living in Virginia during an extraordinary reform movement to end gerrymandering, the lessons I've learned are that actually people do matter. And even when politicians dominate the process and monopolize the process, public pressure still works. And it works when we are paying attention to what they are doing. And so I'd say for you folks in San Luis Obispo County, go to your county board of supervisors, live stream their meetings, ask them questions with your 2 minutes of time or however much time you have, and start holding them accountable, because that actually works. It doesn't mean that it's going to happen overnight, but I would say keep putting the pressure on and keep trying and keep holding our politicians to account, because we still got something that works pretty well here, I'd say. And I still think that most politicians are worried about what their constituents think. And so the point is, you need to make your voice heard if you care about reform and if you care about changing our elections.
Great. Thank you, Alex. Good point. And this is Central Coast Voices. I thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Okay. Glad you're here. Next week, Chris Kington Barker will be with us. We alternate weeks, as most of you know, if you're regular listeners. We don't have Chris's program for next week all finalized yet. So just wait and listen for the announcements that come over KCBX on a regular basis. We remind you also that Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, along with KCBX. The Vital Signs Understanding San Luis Obispo County report is available at actionslo.org. Gives you every 3 years we do a snapshot of where both economically, educationally, and welfare wise the county is for the overall well-being of our citizens. You can contact us at voices@kcbx.org. Suggestions for programs, critiques, feedback is what we would like to hear from you about how we may be able to do this program for you in a better way. That's voices@kcbx.org. Thanks to this being a joint project with KCBX and the Community Foundation. So thank you to Brad Kyle, our in-studio engineer at KCBX. He's still fighting all the meanies in the building while we still do this remotely. And thank you again to my guests today, Alex Kina, Michael Latner, and Tony. Count On would require very few questions from me, because the three of you would keep it going. This has been Central Coast Voices. We'll see you next week. Thank you, gentlemen.